Welcome to The Health Edge, translating the science of self-care. I'm Mark Pettis, and I'm with my friend, colleague, John Bagnulo. John, good afternoon, bud.
Hey, great to see you, Mark.
Great to see you as well. In our last few podcasts, we have looked at both the relationship between higher glycemic acellular carbohydrates and cardiovascular mortality, and certainly a major driver of chronic complex diseases of all sorts. And we also looked at this concept of microbiota accessible carbohydrates, and really, I think a good distinction between fermentable fiber, which is usually in the form of lower glycemic plant-based foods, as compared to those simple starches, flour, you know, grains, where we know the fermentable fiber and the quality of those fermentable metabolic byproducts is very different. And so making the distinction between not just the glycemic effect, but the carbohydrate quality, and they go hand in hand. Those with higher glycemic effects tend to have less effective microbiota accessible carbohydrate. And we've touched on repeatedly, John, over the last 5-6 years on the Health Edge, of the critical importance of high insulin levels and inflammation. Inflammation may be most easily defined as disruption of the normal regulatory drivers of an immune response, inflammation being a tendency to have an accentuated immune response that is protracted, how these are really some of the primary metabolic fault lines for all chronic complex diseases. And that really is a pretty good segue, John, for the paper that we're going to look at here and briefly discuss today. And let me just, I'm going to share my screen for 1 second. So our listeners can just see. So this was a recently published paper in a well-established journal called JAMA. And the title of this paper is The Temporal Association Between Body Mass Index, Fasting Insulin, and Systemic Inflammation. And it is widely accepted and to some extent, still very much debated as to whether weight or a higher body mass index precedes insulin resistance, is in fact a cause of insulin resistance and inflammation, or whether higher insulin levels and insulin resistance precede weight gain. And that's more resonant with the insulin obesity hypothesis that researchers like David Ludwig and others have been promoting, and much of their research is demonstrating consistency with those connections. So in this particular article, they looked at a review of all published research that measured over time body mass index, insulin, and markers of inflammation that are usually called C-reactive protein. And looking at scores of studies, they ended up finding 60 that met their criteria for a systematic review that included 5,600 individuals for which they had some temporal measures. And essentially, John, and we can just get into more detail, what they found was that changes in insulin seem to precede temporally changes in body mass index, and inflammation very much seems to track that, suggestion being that increases in insulin for many may precede the tendency toward weight gain. And this very much sort of feeds into some of the models that we've been discussing and talking about in terms of how food, how the biome, how circadian entrainment, all of the many things that we know to influence insulin sensitivity, do seem to be very, very strongly correlated with a tendency for a higher body mass index and a higher inflammatory level. And so I thought this was a really neat paper. I haven't seen much like this, and in a way that allowed you to more temporally establish, at least in what they looked at, these compelling sequences of metabolic events, John. So a little bit of a long-winded context and segue, but let me just sort of hand over to you and how this resonated with your thinking about all of this.
Yeah, it's great, Mark, because it's kind of that which comes first, right? The chicken or the egg here with respect to obesity versus elevations in insulin. And, you know, I think that probably the most fundamental thing to understand about insulin to remind everybody about is it's, I would consider it to be one of the premier like metabolic switches, so to speak. It has like, you know, just so much control over metabolism. And so if it helps us kind of understand this picture a little bit more deeply, it's this simple. When insulin levels are low, and I would use, you know, maybe five as this, I guess, yeah, it's not an arbitrary cutoff. There's some pretty good data behind five being certainly much more optimal than, let's say, eight. And I don't know exactly the range, but I think insulin has a quote unquote normal range, Mark. If you were to, you know, look at labs, I think it goes from like 3 to 26 or 3 to 27. It's a huge range, right? But we all know, anybody that's looked at these know that once insulin levels get in the double digits, it's a problem. And I would even argue that an 8 is an issue. I saw an individual yesterday as an example that had a fasting insulin of 7.4. They had a fasting glucose of 104. And I would say that both of those would probably be missed by most clinicians as being an issue. But if you multiply that 7.4 times 104, you get, you know, something around 770. You divide that by 405. That's the denominator you're going to use. And you get a HOMA IR score of 1.9. And that's, look, that's a red flag. That says that the person's pre-diabetic or insulin resistant. And I don't really like the word pre-diabetic too much because I think it takes some of the, you know, kind of the urgency of change away from the patient. But anyways, I digress. Fasting insulin, it just says so much about what's going on in a person's body. And the first thing you learn in exercise physiology is you get these two opposing hormones, insulin and glucagon, right? And when insulin levels are low, glucagon levels rise, and it causes just an overall draw on the body's reserves. Beta oxidation goes up. So we start burning fat at an accelerated rate. You know, we're really trying to produce, if we can, energy from what the body has to meet our needs. Now, when insulin levels go up, glucagon levels go down, and we go into this more anabolic state where we're storing whatever we've eaten. And so it's just that simple that if we keep our insulin levels lower, we can maintain kind of this, you know, this more balance, this, you know, what we call, you know, for the most part, homeostasis, right? Staying at a healthy weight, having enough beta oxidation or fat burning going on that we're going to meet our metabolic needs through that. But if that insulin level starts to creep up, and I, you know, again, I think five is that number that I try to convey whenever I can as being more normal, more optimal, as opposed to 15 or heaven forbid 25. But if your levels start to creep up, your insulin levels start to creep up, it is pushing the body into this more storage state. And that's lipogenesis. And also, as you know, Mark, then when it comes to cardiovascular health, this is a big mechanism that just doesn't get talked about enough. Insulin drives the production of small, dense LDLs, which are more easily oxidized. And you know, that's what really kind of gets the whole etiology of heart disease going. So yeah, I love this paper. And to your point, Mark, it really builds on some of the things we've talked about here in the last couple of weeks. It's insulin is right. It connects the dots. It connects everything with respect to inflammation and heart disease and, you know, what we see in kind of in the liver of people who are just, you know, really dealing with an excessive burden of these acellular carbohydrates. So, and as a meta-analysis, I think this is a great paper, right? You get 60 studies that were, I think, looked at with pretty good scrutiny here, right? They eliminated the ones that just didn't really make sense or had the kind of the qualification, so to speak. So this really gives us a good picture with good numbers of the connection here with inflammation and insulin at levels that a lot of people would consider normal, right? But we know that that word gets thrown around too much.
And it really disrupts what has been the paradigm of weight gain and obesity for the last couple of generations, John, as a more straightforward calorie accounting proposition, yeah, where regardless of what you're eating, if your calories in is less than what you're expending, weight will not likely be an issue. Or regardless of what you're eating, if your caloric intake exceeds what you're expending, you're looking at the likelihood of weight gain. This totally disrupts that paradigm and focuses much more on the insulinogenic or insulin-driving output of the foods that you're eating. And as you look back epidemiologically at many of the nutritional guidelines, and people that have been listening to the Health Edge for a long time have heard us say this repeatedly, when your guidelines are pretty much revolving around low-fat paradigms, the consequences of that will be a very substantial carbohydrate intake. And because the nature of those carbohydrates tends to be high glycemic, acellular carbohydrates with very little in the way of microbiota accessible fermentable fiber, it's not hard to understand how the obesity epidemic has really exploded over the last two generations in a way that is much more explained by this insulin hypothesis. And that's a very different proposition in terms of how to help somebody manage their metabolic health, right, John? And part of that does require becoming reacquainted with whole natural healthy fat sources that will have very little, if any, significant insulin response. The key there being of fats of good quality, because we do know that a lot of the omega-6 fats, as processed seed vegetable oils, are pro-inflammatory, and anything that is pro-inflammatory will create insulin resistance. And once you're insulin resistant, your insulin levels will go up, and you can begin to appreciate this sort of vicious cycle that can be very hard for anyone to extract themselves from if they continue to embrace the paradigms that we've been pretty much giving people for the last couple of generations. So I do find this very reaffirming in terms of thinking differently about obesity and metabolism in general, and how we can begin to engage and help people in a more effective way by adapting our messaging to this evolving science, John, because that message has to change. And it's still very locked into our cultural, scientific, clinical way of thinking. It's still very much of a calorie focus. Yeah.
It really is, Mark. It's so pervasive that, you know, I will meet people, you know, with graduate degrees. As you know, this myth, it's not limited, right, to one particular area. It's across the board. People are under this, they have this notion that it's just calories in versus calories out, right? You can exercise more, create more of a deficit, everything's going to be okay. We know that's not the case. It's not a closed system. So you got the whole microbiome component to this. But the point that I like that you just brought up is that these folks that still think I'm just going to eat less, I mean, I'm just going to eat, you know, smaller quantities of things, but they're not going to really address the qualities of what they're eating. You can end up with 1,000 calories a day and still gain weight. And this has been, you know, clinically, this has been demonstrated over and over. If your breakfast is a bagel or a glass of orange juice, right, and it gets your insulin levels up for a few hours, and then your lunch follows suit with a similar type of carbohydrate source, right, some kind of grain-based, flour-based product, or, you know, I don't even have to go to the extremes of drinking, you know, like soft drinks and things like that. I mean, I think we've all seen kind of the Diet Coke syndrome, you know, play out for 20 or 30 years, right? People are drinking Diet Coke 3 or 4 times a day and they can't lose weight. It's because their insulin levels are high chronically. And then that keeps the body into this state of lipogenesis, and it's keeping that person's metabolism away from beta oxidation and really drawing on fat stores. So you can eat a small quantity of food and have that food be just, you know, so carbohydrate dense that even though the calories might be lower than one would, you know, expect in terms of causing weight gain, that's the net effect. So it's really, you know, I've heard it said over and over. I think Dean Ornish was actually the one that probably first titled a book with this, but eat more, weigh less. It actually does. There's a lot of validity to this. It's what you eat. Then the calories become so less important in this discussion, right? I mean, if you get, let's say you get 400 calories from macadamia nuts, but you're not raising your insulin levels, well, the body is going to use those 400 calories very differently than if those 400 calories are coming from a bagel or, you know, some type of, you know, really carbohydrate dense food that drives insulin levels up. Then the body just really doesn't utilize that the same way. And it's fascinating, right? It's that here we are 2021, and yet we're still trying to help some folks understand that it it isn't a calorie counting game. It should be, if anything, it should be, what's the net influence on your insulin levels? I mean, that's really what we should be talking about to help people understand their metabolism.
That really is the take-home message, and it's a very different message for sure. And when I go through my mental checklist, I'll be on a virtual call very soon with someone doing a consultation on them. And this is the sorts of things that I'm thinking about as I hear their story. And I know you think very much the same way, John, but when I'm looking at weight, metabolism, inflammation, I'll begin to think, what is anything that I could possibly share or impart that has some evidence to suggest that you can reduce insulin resistance? And so in the food sense, you know, we've already talked about the importance of eliminating these acellular carbohydrate dense grain-based foods, of getting less of the omega-6 fats and more of whole unprocessed fats, of more fermentable fiber and plant-based foods, and these microbiota-accessible carbohydrates that can influence a biome over our lifetime that can continue to adapt and produce metabolic byproducts that reduce insulin resistance, to non-nutritional issues like the gut and leaky gut and treating things like SIBO, focusing on more natural light exposure, right? Circadian entrainment. These are powerful mediators of insulin and insulin sensitivity. So all these sort of lifestyle interventions, movement, are things that you begin to really connect the dots, because what they all share in common is their tendency to enhance a cell's receptiveness to insulin, and it's that sensitivity that ultimately lowers insulin levels. And with that, as this paper suggests, weight and inflammation, in much the same way that you can reverse that process quickly and see the adverse consequences of that. So it really, I think these concepts are beginning to unify the way we think about how the outside gets inside, how that is translated, and why it's really the metabolic interpretation of the inputs of our lives that we need to be thinking about, and less so, you know, the calories involved or just the simple macronutrient mix without any regard to the quality of that mix. And so it's a much more nuanced story, but it's encouraging to me to see these paradigms continue to shift, because surely in the pandemic we're going to see an epidemiology where many of the public health concerns that we had before the pandemic have only been accelerated As many people have put on weight, have been more sedentary, have been eating comfort foods. And so now you have the indirect consequences of a pandemic that has probably catapulted the aggregate health of many Americans into a much worse place than it was in early 2020. And so the more quickly people can translate this kind of science into the choices they make, the more quickly they can begin to rebound back, independent of the mask and the vaccination or the social distancing.
Yeah, so many inputs into the concept of insulin sensitivity, right? And it's everything from sunlight to movement. I mean, I think when we look at exercise and we look at some of these other components of lifestyle, again, we have this kind of notion that, well, exercise really creates a calorie deficit. And it's so much more complicated than that. I mean, the exercise is so beneficial, but it isn't because you go for a run at a modest pace. I mean, if it were simply about the calorie deficit that run created, you might be able to eat, another 150 to 200 calories a day, right? But it's just that motion enhances on the cellular level, to your point, it enhances the effectiveness of those receptors, and movement is just so complex in terms of the benefits. And, you certainly know much more about the benefits of sunlight than myself, but certainly sunlight outside of the whole vitamin D story, sunlight on its own enhances, the effectiveness, so to speak, of insulin and those receptors. So everything that we can put in place, all these different variables, they ultimately lead us to, this better place with insulin sensitivity. And it's, we get sometimes myopic, right? We look at one thing, but it's the confluence of all these things that really produces that kind of that optimal level of insulin sensitivity that is the solution for everything, right? It's anti-inflammatory. It enhances immune function. It gives us protection against, so much, whether it be cancer or a virus. And it says that's just the way we got to start looking at things if we can, and more holistically, kind of on the kind of macro 30,000 foot level. But I look at this paper, Mark, like you do. It's one that really, because of the way it connects the dots and provides people with an overview of this, I think it's great. It's very refreshing to see.
Well, good discussion, John. Nice to connect today. And we encourage our listeners to check out the website, which is thehealthedgepodcast.com. For any open source article that we can share, we will do so. And it's posted at that site. And so, our videos can be found on YouTube. So please check that out if you wish. And so, John, great to see you, man. And we will reconnect next week. Peace, brother.
I look forward to it. Take care.